Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 31st, 2022 Monday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles. RTD still struggling with staff shortages, written by John Murray. Mining History Probed in Blaze, written by John Aguilar. And Efforts to Ban Books, Spread Across the U.S. by Elizabeth A. Harris and Alexandra Alter of the New York Times. And following up with miscellaneous articles. RTD still struggling with staff shortages. Pandemic has worsened some worker gaps, hamstringing service by John Murray. As boarding counts inched up on the regional transportation district's fast recovering bus routes in the fall, officials faced a frustrating reality. They couldn't run buses more often, extend service hours, or restore pandemic-suspended routes, including additional Flatiron Flyer lines to Boulder County stops. Their drivers were stretched too thin, the result of a deepening operator shortage that became a crisis more than 6 years ago. Once we got out of the initial pandemic and got back into trying to bring back service, it became our primary issue, and it still is our primary issue, said Bill Saros, RTD's senior manager of transit-oriented communities and a leader of its Reimagining RTD Planning Initiative. Ridership is slowly recovering, reaching about 53% of pre-pandemic levels in November, and Metro Denver's transit agency faces increasing pressure to add back more services. But the staffing shortages, which extend beyond its bus and train operators to other key jobs, have grown worse in some ways in the last 2 years, posing an even greater challenge than money. Overall, RTD says services levels stand at about 70% of what they were prior to the pandemic. On most bus routes and trains, that is sufficient to handle current ridership. But top officials have acknowledged to the agency's board in recent months that some of them are getting crowded enough to merit additional service. On the labor side, Deborah Johnson, the CEO and general manager since late 2020, told board members that the agency had fallen short in its recruiting efforts in the past. It's retooling, she said, to attract more workers in an increasingly competitive job market that's resulted in national shortages at transit agencies, the trucking industry, and in many other sectors. Both agency and union leaders expressed hope in interviews that contract negotiations underway now would result in a new agreement that increases pay and improves work conditions, making it easier to close job gaps. A bus operations report filed this month shows that during all of 2021, the division hired 91 people, while 167 left their jobs. Just since last summer, its bus driver vacancies have increased from 134 full and part-time positions to 174, or 18% of operator jobs. Across RTD's operations, several other positions are short by 20% or more, including operators for the N-Line commuter rail train, general repair technicians, track maintainers, and two categories of mechanics, according to updated numbers provided by RTD to the Post. Among 10 positions, the highest vacancy rate was 40% for signal and power maintainers, with 21 of 52 jobs unfilled. Overall, it's still crushing. We're talking about shortages to meet the shortages we have right now, said Lance Longenbone, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 001, which represents many of those employees. One factor that long hindered both hiring and operator retention has gone away, mandated overtime. RTD began requiring sixth shifts each week for hundreds of lower tenured bus operators in 2015 and followed suit for many train operators later, but the practice ended nearly 2 years ago. Johnson says she doesn't want to resurrect it. Before the pandemic, RTD had proposed a plan to trim back service in early 2020 to eliminate the need for required overtime. Instead, its board ended up slashing service much more severely, by about 40%, after ridership plummeted by 70% in the early days of the pandemic. RTD has since restored some service, with the most recent notable additions taking effect in September. But two more batches of service changes have followed, first for January and now for this coming May, without substantial restorations given the staff situation. RTD recently proposed a system optimization plan produced through the Reimagine initiative. If approved, it would serve as a guide map to restore service to 85% of pre-pandemic levels within the next 5 years, with significant shifts in current service to make it more efficient, serving more riders. But can RTD pull it off? As ridership comes back, we hope, expect, and intend to have the operators and mechanics and all the support necessary to be able to grow it over those multiple years, said Bill Van Meter, the agency's assistant general manager of planning. So there's going to be this art and balancing act for us. We're not making headway, Rail Chief says. Notably, the Rail Operations Division has made progress in closing its gap for light rail operators, with vacancies now at 15 out of 190 positions, or 8%, down from roughly a third 2 years ago. Last year, through November, the division reported hiring 68 people while 71 left their jobs, a ratio that at least was closer to treading water. But the division's leader isn't breathing easy. We're not making headway, Assistant General Manager Dave Jensen said, adding, we're not drowning, water's not flooding us, but we're losing ground in as much as I haven't been able to cover the absentee rate. For riders, the shortages mean unpredictable bus and train schedules, with a smattering of runs canceled on a near daily basis. That happens when an operator is out and RTD exhausts its extra boards of operators on standby, along with other forms of backup that have included enlisting supervisors. Cancellations also have occurred on commuter rail lines, especially on the A line in recent weeks, when RTD can't supply a second crew member to provide security as required for those trains under federal law. One worker's absence can mean several canceled runs spread out across a day. The last month saw increasing cancellations on short notice as RTD dealt with a surge of COVID-19 cases within its ranks as the Omicron variant spread. Variations on RTD's problem have played out elsewhere. New York City's subway system recently attempted to lure back retired workers to fill temporary jobs. San Diego's Metropolitan Transit System trimmed its bus schedules by 8% to avoid canceling trips. And the Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority also opted to reduce bus service as it grapples with an operator shortage. Like manufacturing, trucking, construction, and several other industries, public transit providers have struggled to recruit the next generation of workers, a problem that goes back years before the pandemic. RTD is among transit agencies seeing high rates of retirement. Between 2010 and 20, the share of transit workers nationally who were 55 or older increased from 30% to 42%, according to an analysis by the Shared Use Mobility Center. We're all facing the same challenges, and we're also seeking the same workforce, said Pamela Boswell, the Vice President of Workforce Development at the American Public Transportation Association. I would tell you, she added, that there are many transit agencies that are reviewing their recruitment, hiring, and training practices, realizing that this is a new workforce and there has to be an enhanced level of training to encourage employees to stay there. RTD's approach includes a hiring bonus. RTD began offering a $4,000 hiring bonus for many positions in mid-November. In an interview with the Post, Human Resources Director Rachel McMurray detailed the recent expansion of her recruiting team from 4 to 6 and other efforts that she said were helping RTD to develop a more purposeful approach to hiring. Jensen and his bus operations counterpart, Assistant General Manager Fred Worthen, said their hiring challenges have changed during the pandemic. For starters, the agency stopped hiring early on, then in late 2020 issued layoff notices to about 250 operators and other frontline employees, before rescinding them in early 2021 after a new batch of federal pandemic aid was promised. Such decisions made under financial duress eroded earlier progress. Increased competition from other types of employers means fewer applications are coming in these days, and current pandemic social distancing protocols limit the size of each training class, Jensen said, reducing their capacity. It's also a different story with workers who leave. Before 2020, a lot of our attrition had to do with the mandatory overtime, Worthen said. Now we're primarily hearing from folks that are leaving. One, I can't afford to live in Denver anymore. Others, though, are finding more competitive wages and they're moving to jobs that pay more. Many other jobs are also bring less hassle, Longenbone said, noted, and less interaction with the public at a time when nerves are frayed more than usual. Johnson, RTD's CEO, expressed hope in an interview that the next contract with the ATU local, which is under negotiation now, would provide a big assist for both recruitment and retention. The current contract expires at the end of February. She tabbed pay rates and quality of life issues, which include split shift scheduling, as pain points she agrees need to be addressed. Current starting pay is $20.58 per bus and train operators who must complete several weeks of training and earn a commercial driver's license, and $26.08 for mechanics. I need to have a workforce that feel as if they're supported, Johnson said. For now, workers are stretched thin, but on their own terms. RTD still relies heavily on voluntary overtime, offering extra incentives. It paid out $6.1 million last year through October, according to records requested by the Post. At the height of mandating in 2019, RTD paid $13 million in overtime. Private providers that operate 45% of RTD's fixed bus routes on contract do not disclose their vacancies, while Denver Transit Operators, which runs the A, B, and G commuter rail lines, says its operator ranks are fully staffed. But the bus contractors at least have filled gaps using voluntary overtime and occasionally mandated extra shifts, RTD says in its report. First Transit, the largest bus contractor, advertises a $5,000 hiring bonus on its job listings in Denver for operators' jobs that pay $20.66 an hour, slightly higher than RTD. New bus drivers, one returning, begin jobs. Count Deza Jones, 27 among those hoping the new RTD contract brings a pay increase, arguing its starting salary for operators doesn't go far enough in Denver. The daughter of a longtime RTD dispatcher, she worked for about 2 years as a bus driver on Route 15 along East Colfax Avenue, but she said she left in 2019, finding other work as a driver that was lower stress for the mother of a toddler. She also was burned out from RTD's mandated extra shifts, she said, combined with verbal abuse from riders and other stresses of the job. Jones returned to RTD recently, finishing her training in December. She said she was excited to return and realized she'd missed her second family among RTD drivers. You know, a lot of drivers, we go through a lot down there, you know, though from customers arguing to sometimes being assaulted, Jones said. So I was just sensing a personality in myself where I felt like I was just angry all the time, and I just needed that 2-year break to really blossom into the person I am now. Joining Jones from the same training class on the extra board of fill-in drivers is Bernadette Wallace, 43, who said she applied to RTD after working for more than 3 years as a trucker. She settled in North Glen, where her sister lives. Apparently, I drive a bus like I drive a truck. Everybody agrees, even down to how I hold the steering wheel and make extra wide turns, Wallace said. She expressed hope for the job and said she planned to stay for at least 5 years. She predicted driving a bus would play to her strong suits. One, I'm going to get to actually learn all the roads and know where things are. I'm looking forward to that, Wallace said. For the most part, I mean, I think I'll be good at the job. I've been doing customer service jobs since I was 13. I've been doing the driving jobs for years, and I love to drive, so it's just trying to mix the two in one place. Mining history probed in blaze. An underground coal fire is one of the potential causes investigators are looking into, by John Aguilar. It is impossible to extinguish this fire smoke and other gases from the fire emptying themselves through chimneys reaching to the surface in many places, make it look like a group of burning volcanoes, Mine Inspector John McNeil assessing the state of coal mines on Marshall Mesa, 1883. 139 years after McNeil wrote those words, Boulder County investigators are looking at the possibility that burning coal under Marshall Mesa, still smoldering nearly a century after the last mine there shuttered, somehow ignited the ground above, sparking last month's Marshall fire. It's just one of several theories that investigators are weighing as a cause of the December 30th fire that, with the help of ferocious winds, swept east into Superior and Louisville and destroyed more than 1,000 homes. Authorities have also been investigating a religious compound near Marshall Mesa, where a passerby recorded cell phone footage of a shed on fire shortly before evacuation orders were issued. Firefighters had responded to reports of a trash fire on the property, which is occupied by the 12 Tribes group, less than a week before the Marshall fire exploded. The investigation into the cause and origin of the Marshall fire remains ongoing, Boulder County Sheriff's Office spokeswoman Carrie Haverfield wrote in an email to the Denver Post. We are investigating any and all potential causes of the fire, including coal mines in the area, power lines, human activity, etc. But a coal mine triggered wildfire on the Mesa, which sits southeast of Marshall Road in Colorado 93, isn't without precedent. In December 2005, authorities concluded that a brush fire that broke out in the popular hiking area was started by a hot vent, which was measured at a toasty 373 degrees, connected to a long-abandoned mine. While that fire was quickly put out, a similar fire in Glenwood Springs 3 years earlier took a darker turn. It's believed that a burning underground coal seam in West Glenwood started a blaze that, driven by high winds, burned down 29 homes and torched 12,000 acres. Guillermo Rain, a professor of fire sciences at Imperial College London who has studied coal seam fires, said there are hundreds of old coal mines on fire worldwide, especially in China and India. There are quite a few in the United States as well, he said, including one that started in the 1960s in Centralia, Pennsylvania, that prompted almost the entire town to pick up and leave. Colorado has many ongoing coal fires, Rain said. It is hard to detect them because they burn underground, releasing little heat and little smoke. The fact is that these fires represent a hazard and carry a low risk, but are not of zero risk. The Colorado Division of Reclamation, Mining and Safety in 2018 commissioned an inventory of the state's 38 high-priority underground fires. The study done by consulting and engineering firm Tetra Tech took a close look at the Marshall Mine in the fall of that year. Coal mines operated in the Marshall Mesa area from 1863, before Colorado was a state, until 1939. The fire area was inspected and no signs of fire features or snow melt were observed, the report read. Additionally, no coal combustion odors were noted during the site visit. Tetra Tech determined that the fire's activity is very low and thus presents little potential to start a surface fire, while the firm said the Marshall Mine fire poses limited risk to public safety and that no abatement was needed at the site. It said due to the fire's erratic behavior over the years, it is recommended that it be monitored annually to check for increases in fire activity. Tetra didn't return a request for comment for this story. Chris Arend, a spokesman for the Colorado Department of Natural Resources, said the state has not made any additional observations at the site since 2018. He said Colorado's inactive mine reclamation program within the Division of Reclamation, Mining and Safety does not have statutory responsibility or mandate to monitor and or mitigate underground coal mine fires at abandoned sites. He said the responsibility to monitor old mines generally falls on the landowner, which in the case of Marshall Mesa is Boulder Open Space and Mountain Parks, which bought the property in the early 1970s. The inactive mine reclamation program receives federal funding that can be used to assist landowners in monitoring and mitigating abandoned coal mine fires, but monitoring by the program is discretionary and generally at the invitation of the landowner who provides DRMS with legal surface access, Aaron said. Boulder spokeswoman Sarah Huntley sees things differently. While the city owns the land overlying the Marshall Mine, she said, all issues associated with the reclamation of the former mine site are entirely the province of other governmental agencies. We cooperate with these entities, she said. The 2018 Mine Inventory Report noted that workers in 2006 had filled in vents associated with the mine with 275 tons of aggregate material to minimize the potential for another grass fire. 10 years later, two areas near the mine that had subsided or sunk down were excavated, compacted, and backfilled to natural grade. Aaron said the best way to extinguish a subterranean fire is to completely excavate and cool it, but this requires significant resources and is often logistically impossible. Rain, the Imperial College London professor, said smoldering coal is easy to ignite but hard to extinguish. Suppression of a coal fire is very hard and requires plenty of resources and time. It requires a lot of water, like flooding to the top of the galleries of the mine, or sealing completely the access of air into the mine for years or decades until the fire is slowly smothered by lack of oxygen, he said. This is why I say these fires are the most persistent on the planet. Efforts to ban books spread across the U.S. by Elizabeth A. Harris and Alexander Alter of the New York Times. In Wyoming, a county prosecutor's office considered charges against library employees for stocking books like Sex is a Funny Word and This Book is Gay. In Oklahoma, a bill was introduced in the state Senate that would prohibit public school libraries from keeping books on hand that focus on sexual activity, sexual identity, or gender identity. In Tennessee, the McMinn County Board of Education voted to remove Mouse, a Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel from an eighth-grade module on the Holocaust, because of nudity and curse words. Parents, activists, school board officials, and lawmakers around the country are challenging books at a pace not seen in decades. The American Library Association said in a preliminary report that it received an unprecedented 330 reports of book challenges, each of which can include multiple books, in the fall. It's a pretty startling phenomenon here in the United States to see book bans back in style, to see efforts to press criminal charges against school librarians, said Suzanne Nossel, chief executive of free speech organization PEN America, even if efforts to press charges have so far failed. Such challenges have long been a staple of school board meetings, but it isn't just their frequency that has changed, according to educators, librarians, and free speech advocates. It is also the tactics behind them and the venues where they play out. Conservative groups in particular, fueled by social media, are now pushing the challenges into state houses, law enforcement, and political races. The politicization of the topic is what's different than what we've seen in the past, said Britton Follett, chief executive content at Follett School Solutions, one of the country's largest providers of books to K-12 schools. It's being driven by legislation. It's being driven by politicians aligning with one side or the other. And in the end, the librarian, teacher, or educator is getting caught in the middle. Among the most frequent targets are books about race, gender, and sexuality, like George M. Johnson's All Boys Are Blue, Aren't Blue, Jonathan Evason's Lawn Boy, Maya Kobab's Gender Queer, and Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. Advocacy group No Left Turn in Education maintains lists of books it says are used to spread radical and racist ideologies to students, including Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States and Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. Those who are demanding certain books be removed insist this is an issue of parental rights and choice, and that all parents should be free to direct the upbringing of their own children. Others say prohibiting these titles altogether violates the rights of other parents and the rights of children who believe access to these books is important. Many school libraries already have mechanisms in place to stop individual students from checking out books of which their parents disapprove. Author Lori Halsey Anderson, whose young adult books have frequently been challenged, said that pulling titles that deal with difficult subjects can make it harder for students to discuss issues like racism and sexual assault. By attacking these books, by attacking the authors, by attacking the subject matter, what they are doing is removing the possibility for conversation, she said. You are laying the work for increasing bullying, disrespect, violence, and attacks. Tiffany Justice, a former school board member in Indian River County, Florida, and a founder of Moms for Liberty, said that parents should not be vilified for asking if a book is appropriate. Some of the books being challenged involve sexual activity, including oral sex and anal sex, she said, and children are not ready for that kind of material. There are different stages of development of sexuality in our lives, and when that's disrupted, it can have horrible long-term effects, she said. Book challenges aren't just coming from the right. Of Mice and Men and To Kill a Mockingbird, for example, have been challenged over the years for how they address race, and both were among the Library Association's 10 most challenged books in 2020. In the Mukilteo School District in Washington State, the school board voted last week to remove To Kill a Mockingbird, voted the best book of the past 125 years in a survey of readers conducted by the New York Times Book Review, from the ninth grade curriculum at the request of staff members. Their objections included arguments that the novel marginalized characters of color, celebrated white saviorhood, and used racial slurs dozens of times without addressing their derogatory nature. Political leaders on the right have seized on the controversies over books. The newly elected governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, a Republican, rallied his supporters by framing book bans as an issue of parental control and highlighted the issue in a campaign ad featuring a mother who wanted Toni Morrison's Beloved to be removed from her son's high school curriculum. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott demanded that the state's education agency investigate any criminal activity in our public schools involving the availability of pornography, a move that librarians in the state fear could make them targets of criminal complaints. The governor of South Carolina asked the state's superintendent of education and its law enforcement division to investigate the presence of obscene and pornographic materials in its public schools, offering genderqueer as an example. The mayor of Richland, Mississippi, recently withheld funding from the Madison County Library System, saying he would not release the money until books with LGBTQ themes were removed, according to the library system's executive director. George M. Johnson, author of All Boys Aren't Blue, a memoir about growing up black and queer, was stunned in November to learn that a school board member in Flagler County, Florida, had filed a complaint with the sheriff's department against the book. Written for readers aged 14 and older, it includes scenes that depict oral and anal sex and sexual assault. "I didn't know that was something you could do, file a criminal complaint against a book," Johnson said in an interview. The complaint was dismissed by the sheriff's office, but the book was subsequently removed from school libraries while it was reviewed by a committee. So far, efforts to bring criminal charges against librarians and educators have largely faltered, as law enforcement officials in Florida, Wyoming, and elsewhere have found no basis for criminal investigations. And courts have generally taken the position that libraries should not remove books from circulation. Nonetheless, librarians say that just the threat of having to defend against charges is enough to get many educators to censor themselves by not stocking the books to begin with. Even just the public spectacle of an accusation can be enough. "It will certainly have a chilling effect," said Deborah Caldwell Stone, director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. "You live in a community where you've been for 28 years, and all of a sudden you might be charged with the crime of pandering obscenity, and you'd hope to stay in that community forever." Three men filed suits against city. Lawsuits? Denver officers shot them in the eye with less lethal munitions during 2020 protests, by Elise Schmelzer. Three men filed lawsuits against the city of Denver last week, alleging police needlessly and recklessly shot them in the eye with less lethal munitions during the 2020 racial justice protests, leaving two of them partially blind. The three men, Jax Feldman, Nicholas Orlin, and Sean Murphy, allege in two lawsuits that they were shot in the face without warning while they were unarmed and not acting violently or destroying property. The lawsuits allege officers intentionally aimed at people's faces and fired without warning, problems also identified by the city's top law enforcement watchdog in a scathing report criticizing how police handled the 2020 protests. The city's failure to constrain its officers in any way, despite being aware of the many injuries its officers had caused and were causing during the protests, is clear evidence of the city's utter and deliberate indifference to the customary use of excessive and disproportionate force toward protesters, attorney Burke Bumgardner, who filed both lawsuits, wrote in the complaints. The Denver Police Department and the Denver City Attorney's Office declined to comment on the lawsuits, citing a policy to not discuss pending litigation. The two federal civil rights lawsuits had to at least add to at least nine others filed on behalf of more than 60 people injured or arrested during the protests, and civil rights attorneys have said more lawsuits are in the works. The Denver City Council last week approved a $500,000 settlement to a student whom police shot in the eye with a foam bullet. Feldman wasn't participating in the protests when he was shot in the face with a pepper ball on May 30, 2020, a lawsuit filed Tuesday on his behalf states. He was walking back to his car after meeting with a friend when a truck carrying Denver police officers passed him at the corner of East Colfax Avenue and Grant Street. Feldman yelled, "We're all Americans," at the truck as it passed. Surveillance video from a nearby property provided to the Denver Post by Bumgardner shows Feldman yelling at the truck seconds before a projectile blasts near his head and explodes on the ground nearby. Feldman, 21 years old at the time, grabbed his eye as it passed. Doctors determined that Feldman's eye was damaged beyond repair and would eventually have to be removed, the lawsuit states. The injury permanently altered his appearance and limited his depth perception and peripheral vision. A Denver Police Internal Affairs investigation found that Feldman was struck in the face with a pepper ball, a copy of the investigatory report shows, but investigators could not identify which officer on the truck fired the weapon. Several officers on the truck had their body camera turned off at the time of the incident. One officer's body camera captures Feldman yelling at the truck and the sound of pepper ball guns being fired, but does not show Feldman being struck or who fired at him. None of the officers issued a warning before firing the less lethal munitions, the video shows. Bumgardner, however, believes that Officer Diego Archuleta fired the pepper ball at Feldman. He was the only officer armed with a pepper ball gun in a position to fire toward Feldman at the time of the incident, Bumgardner alleged in the lawsuit, which names Archuleta and 11 other officers as defendants. While plaintiff was unarmed, non-threatening, and non-confrontational, defendant Archuleta and the other defendant officers on the DPD vehicle were armed and fully outfitted in protective riot gear, and they were safely on board the moving police vehicle that enabled defendant Archuleta to approach, aim, shoot plaintiff in the eye, and incapacitate him, and quickly ride away without ever being at any risk of harm by plaintiff, the lawsuit states. Archuleta is one of the two Denver officers formally disciplined for their actions during protests. He was suspended without pay for 6 days for using pepper spray on a woman sitting in her car who also did not pose a threat to officers, which he admitted was a mistake. Archuleta resigned from the department January 6th, Denver police spokesman Jay Casillas said. Court records show he pleaded guilty to a felony charge of attempted strangulation in Denver District Court that same day. "We're happy to see that the city is making reasonable settlements with people they've injured, and we certainly hope they'll do the same with Jax, who was just an innocent bystander in this whole manner," Bumgardner said. Orlin and Murphy also suffered eye injuries during the protests and on Thursday jointly sued the city, alleging police violated their civil rights. Orlin attempted to cover a tear gas canister deployed near the intersection of Lincoln Street and East Colfax Avenue at about 6:30 p.m., May 30, 2020, according to the lawsuit. Police shot Orlin in the face with a less lethal projectile, rendering him unconscious. The injury rendered him permanently partially blind in his left eye. Murphy was also standing at the intersection at the same time as Orlin, though the men did not know each other. Police shot Murphy in the face with a projectile without warning, the lawsuit alleges. Murphy underwent emergency surgery in his left eye that evening. Surgeons were able to save his eye, though his vision is permanently diminished and his face is permanently scarred, according to the lawsuit. The lawsuit alleges officers purposefully aimed and fired their weapons and loaded with one of these hard projectiles directly at the plaintiff's respective heads, faces, and eyes. And from the series, Faces of the Front Range, this is their one hot meal a day. People's Needs Drive Businessman Abels to Volunteer by Judith Kohler. The greeting that Richard Abels got when Lafayette Willis came to the door as part of his payment as a volunteer for the Meals on Wheels program. Willis, standing in the door of his home in Denver's Park Hill neighborhood, said he's been getting the daily hot meals for a little while, and he's real good at bringing them. "I appreciate him so much," said Willis, motioning toward Abels. "He always greets me with a smiling face." "Underneath the mask," Abels said. For the past 2 years, just before the coronavirus pandemic hit, Abels signed up to help with the Volunteers of America Colorado program. The organization prepares and delivers an average of 600,000 meals a year out of its kitchen at its headquarters in the Five Points neighborhood. From 500 to 600 hot meals are delivered each day, and about 750 boxes with a five-day supply of frozen meals are delivered each week to people who are homebound. Abels and other volunteers provide the people power to ensure that those who aren't able to go shopping or fix their own meals don't go without food. All of these clients are the most part. They don't get out, and they don't have mobility. This is their one hot meal a day, Abels said. After being in the corporate world and running his own communications consulting business, Abels was looking for a way to contribute that was very on the ground, really grassroots. "I had known about Volunteers of America and Meals on Wheels, and I saw something one day that said they were looking for drivers, and I sort of put that in the back of my head," Abels said. He figures some days he's one of the few people the clients see. "What better things to do than to help people out who are really in the situation," he said. The 70-year-old Abels, who moved to Denver from Chicago 43 years ago, worked a little bit in the VOA kitchen where the food is prepared, but likes delivering the meals better. "I like the interaction with the people, even if it's just, 'Hi, how are you? It's good to see you. You're doing okay today.'" Abels has gotten to know his clients. In some cases, he knocks on the door to let them know their food has arrived and waves to them. Other clients ask him to put the food in the freezer for them. If it snows, he has asked clients if they want him to shovel their walk. "Abels also fills in when other drivers can't make it," said Natalie Gill, a marketing program manager at VOA. "A total of about 150 people drive the coolers and boxes to central drop-off points and pick up the food to take to individual homes. There's a pretty long wait list right now with certain areas with Meals on Wheels because we don't have the volunteers. We're always in need of Meals on Wheels volunteers," Gill said. "Roughly 130 people are currently on a waiting list to receive the meals. Clients must be 60 or older and live within the 7-county delivery area. There is no cost set for the meals, and people pay what they can or nothing." Abels started out driving a route on Thursdays and added 2 contiguous routes on Fridays. Gill said Abels is willing to take extra shifts and fill in when other volunteers cancel at the last minute. "That's huge for us because things come up and we get a lot of cancellations," Gill said. "Sometimes staff members need to fill in, or you just kind of have to figure it out as you go." Program manager said Abels goes above and beyond, and his connection to the clients always shines through, she added. "Being a Meals on Wheels driver is one of the safer ways to volunteer during the pandemic," Gill said. "You're alone in your car, delivering meals to the client's door." When he started making deliveries, Abels equipped himself with gloves, masks, and hand sanitizer. On a recent delivery day, he pulled into the parking lot of a neighborhood church to pick up the boxes and coolers full of food for the people on his route. Abels pulled out the lists that match people's names with the food they get. Some clients get just 2 hot meals a week. People are provided with emergency boxes with frozen or non-perishable foods in case of bad weather. On Fridays, in addition to the hot meal, we deliver a 2-day frozen box so that they have a meal Saturday and Sunday, Abels said. Hundreds of people keep the wheels rolling for the program, Abels added. They include the cooks, people who box the food, the drivers, and companies who donate the coolers and other items. "The need is, sadly, way too great. You can do a little part, and it's real," Abels said. "I would say that for a really small investment in time, and it could be as little as 2 hours a week or even 2 hours a month, the reward that you get is far bigger." For more information about Meals on Wheels, call 303-294-0111. Now to sports. A super finish. Burrow keeps his cool as he guides Cincinnati to overtime win and trip to the Super Bowl. By Dennis Wasik Jr. of the AP. Hooday. Not those same old Bungles, not even close. Joe Burrow and these young, hungry Cincinnati Bengals are Super Bowl bound as unexpected and tenacious AFC champions. Evan McPherson kicked a 31-yard field goal with 9:22 left in overtime after Burrow kept his cool while leading a furious second-half comeback. They got the Bengals to the NFL's big game for the first time in 33 years with a 27-24 victory over the Kansas City Chiefs for the AFC Championship on Sunday. It's a special team that's capable of doing special things, said Coach Zach Taylor, who was in elementary school the last time the Bengals went to the Super Bowl. We've said that from the get-go. Whether people believed us or not, he added, we believed, so we're not surprised. And who could blame them? The Bengals erased an 18-point deficit, tying an AFC title game record for largest comeback to take a late 24-21 lead on McPherson's 52-yarder. I'd say nobody blinked an eye, the rookie kicker said of the Bengals falling behind big early. I think we all thought we were going to come back and win the game. But Harrison Butker's 44-yard kick as time expired in regulation sent it to overtime a week after his 49-yarder on the final play of regulation did the same against Buffalo. And after the Bills' Josh Allen called tails and it came up heads for the overtime coin toss in that one, giving Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs the ball to seal a wild 42-26 victory, Cincinnati backup quarterback Brandon Allen called heads and the coin came up tails. The Chiefs opened overtime again with the ball, but Von Bell intercepted Mahomes on the third play, and Burrow and the Bengals took over. And now they're headed to the Super Bowl for the first time since 1989, after winning their first playoff overtime game. Usually when you lose the coin flip to those guys, you're going home, said Burrow, the Bengals' second-year quarterback. Our defense really stepped up and made plays in the second half. And on offense, we made plays when we had to. I thought the offensive line played really well all day. We started running the ball there at the end, and that's exciting. Big win for us. You might say that. The Bengals will play the winner of the NFC Championship between the San Francisco and the Los Angeles Rams in the Super Bowl in Los Angeles on February 13th. Cincinnati lost to the 49ers in both of its previous trips to the Super Bowl. Mahomes and the Chiefs will be left to lament blowing a chance at a third straight Super Bowl appearance. When you're up 21-3 at any point in the game, you can't lose, Mahomes said. I put that on myself. The Chiefs had a chance at a winning touchdown in the closing seconds of regulation, but sacks by Sam Hubbard on consecutive plays forced Kansas City to settle for the tying field goal. We're going to the Super Bowl, Hubbard said. It sounds crazy to say that. The Bengals have won 6 of their last 7 games against the Chiefs, including 2 this season, but it didn't look good for Cincinnati earlier in this one. The Chiefs got a touchdown on their first 3 possessions, with Mahomes finding Mecole Hardman for a 3-yard score that made it 21-3 and had this one looking very much like a rout. Mahomes joined Tom Brady, Joe Flacco, and Aaron Rodgers as the only players with 3 games with 3 or more TD passes in a single postseason. But Burrow kept the Bengals in it. He tossed a short pass to Sam G. Perrin, who avoided a tackle attempt by Chevarius Ward and raced into the end zone for a 41-yard touchdown with 1:05 left in the opening half. The Chiefs appeared headed for their 4th straight touchdown drive to open the game, especially after Byron Pringle's 10-yard catch put Kansas City at the 15 with 13 seconds left, setting off chants from the fired-up Arrowhead Stadium crowd of 13 seconds who were still reveling in the Chiefs' stunning comeback last week against Buffalo. A pass interference call on Eli Apple in the end zone put the ball on the 1, but the Chiefs couldn't get into the end zone on 2 tries with the Mahomes pass to Tyreek Hill losing a yard and ending the half. It ended up costing them. I was hoping we could get the ball in the end zone, Coach Andy Reid said. I probably gave the wrong play. First of all, I could have given them something better than that. I'll take responsibility for that one. McPherson's 31-yarder cut the Bengals' deficit to 21-13 with 2:58 left in the third quarter. Cincinnati got the ball back at the Chiefs' 27 moments later when B.J. Hill intercepted Mahomes' short pass intended for DeMarcus Robinson. 2 plays after Joe Mixon gained 2 yards on first and goal from the 5. Jamar Chase went up after Rashan Fenton in the end zone to catch Burrow's toss for a touchdown. Burrow then found a wide-open Trent Taylor for the two-point conversion to tie it at 21 with 14 seconds left in the third quarter. The 18-point comeback by Cincinnati tied Indianapolis for the largest in AFC championship history. "I wouldn't call it surreal. I would say it's exciting," Burrow said. "I think if you would have told me before the season that we'd be going to the Super Bowl, I probably would have called you crazy. Then, you know, we played the whole season, and nothing surprises me now." In L.A. rallies for stunning victory over San Francisco by Greg Beauchamp of the AP. Trayvon Howard made a game-sealing interception with 1:09 to play, and the Los Angeles Rams rallied from a 10-point deficit in the fourth quarter to secure a spot in the Super Bowl at their home stadium next month with a thrilling 20-17 victory over the San Francisco 49ers in the NFC Championship game Sunday night. Cooper Kupp caught 2 touchdown passes from Matthew Stafford for the star-studded Rams, who began the fourth quarter down 17-7 after wasting a multitude of scoring opportunities. But after Kupp's second TD catch and a tying field goal on a drive extended by Tart's brutal dropped interception, the Rams drove for Matt Gay's go-ahead 30-yard field goal with 1:46 to play. Los Angeles' defense then won it when Aaron Donald got a hold of Jimmy Garoppolo and forced him to fling a pass toward Jamichael Hasty. The ball caromed high in the air off Hasty's hands and came straight down to Howard, who didn't miss it. "I've got total trust and confidence in the defense, man," said Stafford, who passed for 337 yards in the third playoff victory of his 13-year career. "They've been unbelievable all year. Way to freaking ice the game. I loved it." Los Angeles will welcome the Cincinnati Bengals in 2 weeks for Super Bowl 56 in Rams owner Stan Kroenke's multi-billion dollar SoFi Stadium. After 54 consecutive Super Bowls without an NFL team playing in its home stadium, the Rams are the second team to do it in 2 seasons after Tampa Bay broke the streak last year. "You can't write the story any better," Stafford said. "I'm at a loss for words. I'm just having a blast playing ball with these guys, and shoot, we've got one more at the home stadium. Let's get it done." The Rams won their second conference title in the past 4 years under coach Sean McVay and moved one step from the franchise's second championship in the Super Bowl era. Perhaps even more impressively, Los Angeles finally snapped a 6-game losing streak against its San Francisco arch rivals, who secured their playoff berth with an overtime comeback victory in Englewood just 3 weeks ago. Debo Samuel and George Kittle caught touchdown passes from Garoppolo, who passed for 232 yards in a heartbreaker for the 49ers. Coach Kyle Shanahan punted twice from the Rams' half of the field and a third time from the 50, and that caution likely ended up costing San Francisco. San Francisco also will lament its late-game execution, but no mistake was bigger than the dropped interception by Tart, who could have put the Rams in dire straits moments after McVay wasted his final timeout on a failed challenge with 10:01 left. In front of a crowd packed with fans of both California clubs, San Francisco held a 10-7 halftime lead after a litany of missed opportunities by Los Angeles. The Rams got to the San Francisco 3 on their second drive, but Kawan Williams alertly tipped an end zone pass to Jimmy Ward for a long interception return. The pick was Stafford's first of the playoffs, but his 5th in 3 games against the Niners. Los Angeles shook it off, got a defensive stop, and made an 18-play, 97-yard drive, consuming more than 9.5 minutes. Kupp capped it with his 16-yard TD catch in the back of the end zone. But the Niners answered with yet another moment of brilliance of Samuel, who caught an inside screen pass and rampaged through the Los Angeles defense. The All-Pro dived to the pylon for his first career postseason scoring catch. The Rams' mistakes multiplied. Kupp and rookie Ben Sharanik dropped potential scoring passes on LA's next drive, which ended with a missed 54-yard field goal by Gay. Samuel shook off a massive clean hit from Rams safety Nick Scott on San Francisco's drive, ending in Robbie Gould's 38-yard field goal at the halftime gun for a 10-7 lead. San Francisco's defense stopped the Rams on downs near midfield in the third quarter, and Garoppolo hit Kittle for his second TD pass moments later. Los Angeles kept it close with a gritty drive, ending in Kupp's 11-yard TD catch early in the fourth quarter. Denver throttles Milwaukee, stretches winning streak to 5 by Mike Singer. Maybe the overrated chants were a bit impulsive, as the Bucks faithful rained down their affectionate chants at the visiting team. Nikola Jokic and the Nuggets wrenched their lead to 25 points and didn't relent. Denver throttled the defending champion Bucks on Sunday night, 136-100, just to stretch their winning streak to 5. Now winners in 10 of its last 13, it was as dominant and significant a win as the Nuggets have authored all season. Team win, Nuggets coach Michael Malone beamed from the post-game press conference. The ball movement was just fantastic. Asking specifically about the season-high 39 assists, Malone said, "It's just our identity, who we are." Jokic amassed 18 points, 15 assists, and 9 rebounds, missing the 13th triple-double of the season only because of the glaring margin. The reigning MVP, whose case for a second one is growing, didn't play the fourth quarter. His primary competition, Giannis Antetokounmpo, finished the night with 29 points on 9 of 19 shooting with 9 rebounds. No other Bucks player scored more than 14. "I think all international players have some kind of connection," Jokic said of his relationship with Antetokounmpo. "Do I want to do what he did to Denver? Yes, I want to do it, of course." Aaron Gordon tallied 24 points on 10 of 17 shooting, including 4 three-pointers. The Nuggets cooked the Nets with 23 makes from beyond the arc, tying their season high. Monte Morris had 4 of them, and rookie Bones Highland drained 3. As a unit, the Nuggets reserves poured in 59 points in the rout. Having seemingly found some cohesion within both units, the Nuggets will surge into Minnesota for another game on Tuesday. The Nuggets played a beautiful brand of basketball to open the second half, passing and cutting and slicing Milwaukee's defense to pieces. One showtime pass from Will Barton gifted Gordon an unimpeded dunk, while Jokic continued serving up his teammates quality shots. Many went to Gordon, whose 11 third-quarter points helped stretch the lead to 22 at one point. If it wasn't Gordon's best shooting display as a Nugget, it was close. Many of his baskets came from well outside the paint, which is generally his comfort zone. Even Jokic added to the parade with a highlight-worthy reverse layup. The Nuggets' offense continued to sizzle from outside, paving the path to a 103-81 lead entering the fourth. Malone sung Highland's praises for his total effort in Friday's win over New Orleans. What I liked about his play in the second half, it started with one, his pace, Malone said. "I think Bones has tremendous quickness. He can get up and down the floor in a hurry. He got us organized, he got us into offense, and he ran his team. 2 years at VCO, his freshman year, he was a point guard. I just like the confidence, the pace, his organization of that team, and him just getting aggressive." Highland made good on Malone's approval. He steered the Nuggets' second unit for 23 first half points as Denver carried a 65-57 lead into halftime. Highland's speed was an X factor. His shiftiness helped collapse the defense, while his distance shooting stretched them apart. Jokic was dominant as well. While the Bucks opted to defend him with guards, usually Jrue Holiday or Wes Matthews, Denver shooters were proficient enough to avoid sending double teams. The Nuggets buried 11 three-pointers in the first half and tallied 19 assists to scramble Milwaukee's defense. Jokic had 9 of the helpers in the first half. Gordon, Morris, and Highland buried three-pointers in each in a devastating display of marksmanship over the first two quarters. As Malone predicted, Antetokounmpo was overwhelming. He pummeled the Nuggets in the paint for 22 first-half points, pacing Milwaukee's inside-out attack. And Colorado ties record for wins in any month by Mike Chambers. The extraordinary Avalanche, thanks to goals from its top three scorers and 30 saves from red-hot goalie Darcy Kemper, impressively extended 5 streaks after defeating the Buffalo Sabres 4-1 at Ball Arena on Sunday night. Team streaks by the numbers? 10. Avalanche winning streak, that's tied with Pittsburgh for longest in the NHL this season and the club's second longest all time. 15. Victories in January, now tied for the NHL record for wins in any month with Pittsburgh and Boston. Colorado is 15-0-1 this month. 16. Point streak. The Avs, who haven't lost in regulation since December 16th at Nashville, tied the 2000-2001 Stanley Cup winning Avs for longest in club history. 18 winning streak at Ball Arena. That's the fifth longest NHL home winning streak and longest since Detroit set the record of 23 in 2011-12. And 31, Colorado is 26-3-2 in its last 31 games, the winningest stretch in club history. "It's fun to win for sure," said Avs center Nazem Kadri, who scored the second goal, the game winner, to break a 1-1 tie in the second period. "It's pretty exceptional if you look at the history of the Avs. We've had some pretty good teams. So, of course, we're humbled by that. That being said, I don't think there's too many complacent guys in the dressing room. I feel like everyone feels that we could still be a little bit better." The Avs, who improved to 25-0-2 when scoring first and 19-0-0 when leading after the first period, again played without top-line center Nathan MacKinnon, who missed his second game with facial fractures and a concussion. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.